first, we get on the telephone line and welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, sir?
Well, we got a little snow up here. We made it to the 17th of December with mostly bare ground, but just in time for the holiday, we're getting that little coating of white.
It's still autumn.
I know. And it'll still be winter, even though the calendar tells us differently sometime in early April when we probably get that last snowstorm. But hey, that's the New England life. We asked for this.
Yes, this is the shortest day of the year yet. Or what is that?
We're closing in. I think it's the 21st. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So right on the nose with winter. It's I like winter. The only thing I have when I do my little folders for my writings for spring 2019, whatever it might be, they have these nice, easy demarcation points. And you don't want to, like, wrap something up before December 31st, right? So my fall technically extends until the last day of the year, and then winter starts January 1, but,
I like that.
But different.
It's a mindset, absolutely. I want to talk about a new piece published in Salmagundi, a very interesting piece of fiction entitled Mint State 87. And, well, how would you describe it?
It's actually an old story, and I just thought it would be good for right now because it's a Christmas story. It's a Christmas story of sorts, but it's not one of those Christmas stories that Christmas work of art that you have to have, like, solely at Christmas, like Meet Me in St. Louis is a film that's kind of a Christmas film, but you don't need it just a Christmas, and Scrooge, the 1951 Alistair Sim film, is that way too. So I wanted to write something like that. And not along those lines plot-wise, but I have these two reoccurring characters in my fiction, of which there's an awful lot of fiction. So it's like, I don't know, 300 stories now. So they have an appearance in maybe 12 or 15 stories at most. But there are these two Irish criminals and friends, and their names are Padraig and Lorcan. And they're also kind of rivals in a way. And Padraig is this, he fancies himself this impressive poet, and he's not really a poet. And sometimes they have stories where they're off doing whatever they're doing together, murdering somebody, or it's just one of them in the story, and that story intersects with someone else's life. In this case, that's the life of a guy who was a fringe, what we call a 4A baseball player. He was like kind of, sort of, maybe tiny bit good enough for the majors, but also not really like a Blake Swihart type of player, but a guy who is a pitcher. And he blows out his arm, and it looks like his career is coming to an end, and he has to accept this. And he gets some counsel from his dad, and his dad says to him essentially, why don't you go to a Cape Cod house instead of just drinking your face off in Boston and gather yourself over the holiday? And as he does that, this guy Lorcan, who's up to something quite different on his own, is going to intersect with this pitcher's life.
Well, and the pitcher, son of a Cape Cod fisherman, named after perhaps the most rubber-armed pitcher in the history of professional baseball.
Yeah, Big Hoss Radbourne, who would really only be known to fans of early baseball, like turn-of-the-century baseball, not 20th and 21st century, but the century before that. Although it's all explained, and see, what you want to do when you're writing stories, if you have a reference in it, it's like when you use a so-called vocabulary word. If you're any good, you're setting up a context where people are going to know what that reference means without having to know it on their own. Like, you don't have to know who Big Hoss Radbourne was. You don't have to know the first thing about baseball to grasp a story like this. And I think that's where a lot of writers go wrong, where if you're not into that putative subject matter or some element of that subject matter, you're going to be lost. Like, if you read a piece somebody's written about Beethoven, if you're not into Beethoven, it's not usually going to make any sense to you. And I think that's poor writing. But ultimately, the larger subject here, not baseball, baseball is just kind of the hobby horse on which some of this is draped. It's going to be this man trying to sort out, this still young man trying to sort out his direction in life and becoming swept up in something that is not strictly legal, not legal at all, but his part in it is, it's sort of a heist story, really. His part in it is going to be on the legal front limited, but it's also going to impart a valuable lesson to him about what to do in terms of next moves in his life.
Absolutely. We're talking with Colin Fleming about his story, Mint State 87. BH's dad is a collector, and that certainly plays into the story quite a bit.
It does. If there's someone out there who collects sports cards or anything like that, you know that right now they're vetted rigorously through a grading system. And coins, too. This is a story about coins, because what Lorcan is going to do, he's sort of day-tripping into Boston to rob the MFA of lots of ancient coins, and it totals something like $75,000. And he has this unwitting accomplice with him. And there's the feds involved, and there's a storage space out on the Cape, and some local yokels are roped into this. But you reach a point with these grades where something gets designated mint state. And so for coins, if you have some like Franklin half dollar, like mint state 85 or whatever it is, they start around there where it's like perfection. And then there's extra perfection. And they have mint state 86, that kind of thing. And what interested me about that was the idea that it's capped. And that's kind of what the story riffs on, this idea that you don't want to cap something as this is my perfection. You always want to have something, or at least the hope of something, beyond that. And so it's tying into an address where one of these people have their house on the Cape, 86 Cavendish Avenue, and the idea that this criminal, who is definitely up to no good, but he's not a horrible person, not a really a bad person at all, and as he's making his impressive haul and then just leaving everybody in the lurch, absconding in the night, he's imparting something to this guy that's more invaluable than his particular coin heist. And so that's the idea of this mint state increasing.
I think my favorite line in the story, you don't need a label on something to know what it's worth.
No, you don't. You certainly don't. In fact, I would say the converse is true. Not that it's a matter of an ink block test and everything is, subjective and whatever it is. That's not what that means. It's almost like the difference between a fact and a truth. And we talk about this as being a post-fact age, and that's another thing that comes up in this story, that a fact only goes so far. People put way too much stock in facts. We can say, for instance, that Roger Maris hit 61 home runs by the definition of what a home run is in 1961. That's a fact. But the task of being an evolving person is a vital component of being human. That's a truth. Now, that's more than a fact. You can't quantify it like a fact because it transcends fact, like a ranking. And that pulls rank on the fact. So that's what's happening here with this idea of labels, because a label is often a limitation. And as you would understand, I'm someone, of course, who is impossible to label with what I do. And I bristle at the notion, anyone who sees something of mine, the first thing of mine that they see, they're going to assume that that's entirely what I am, because I do it so thoroughly. If you see an op-ed of mine, you're going to think, oh, it's Mr. Op-Ed Guy. If you see something that I wrote in hockey, you're going to think I've devoted my life to hockey. If you see my fiction, you're going to think I do not just fiction, but that one kind of fiction. And none of that's true, because I'm beyond all of that. That's the truth. It goes beyond the fact. So that is what that very pithy statement is encapsulating in that particular line that you liked.
You also take a look at the language a little bit and the way words are used and have different meanings. And in this story, it's the word base.
It's the word, sure, right. It's the idea of like a home base or a base on a baseball field. And a base is something that you build off of. And it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, a given word. But it's not just that. It means to the growing person, or the person who's trying to sort out whatever they're dealing with, it means different things at different times. And I think that's what you want people to be cognizant of. It's not a Keystone Cops routine, but there is a lot of miscommunication in this story because people have different motives. But one of the things is we tend to think that somebody's motive is entirely this, the A stream. And my motive over here is the B stream. But your A stream might be 75% A and a little bit D, and you have 10% B in there for me. And that's the large-heartedness that Lorcan has, because he's a kind of shepherd, sort of guardian angel for this guy who is lost. The guy comes, B.H. comes upon Lorcan's house. It's Cape Cod House. He's going out. He's just drinking endlessly, and he's walking around drinking, and he sees this house and this Christmas tree, and he asks if he can take a photo of it and all that kind of jazz. And he hadn't noticed at first that there's someone there. He thinks it's this like unoccupied place, and they build up this relationship. They're hanging out. It's like when you have a relationship when you're younger, and I don't know when they stop now. They probably run out this sort of relationship when we're in our late teens. College years, maybe a year or two after college, where you share interests together, and whether it's magazines or cards or sports or going to the bar and watching the Patriots. And that's what these guys do. And it's a sort of buddy story at the same time, dealing out all of these hard truths. And there's this kind of wonderful moment at the end where the reader, him or herself, they get what's a sort of de facto Christmas present with the end of the story.
Absolutely. By the way, I also love, it's one of my favorite names in your fiction, the name of Lorcan's grandfather.
Well, what is it? I don't even remember.
Comfort Weatherby.
Oh, yeah. You know what's funny about that is, like, when you go around in life and you have things that stick with you, and it's, again, the idea of transposition of a fact and a truth or whatever. I was staying out in Dedham one summer with my aunt and uncle because I had just gone out of college, and there was somebody, these squatters who lived next door to me, and I had complained to my landlady about the squatters, and their landlord knocked on the door and said, this guy has complained, and they were plotting to actually murder me. I overheard this. So I had to flee in the night, and I'm living out in Dedham, and I really had nothing to do that summer. I was looking for work, and I ended up hanging around this old graveyard, just historical, like sort of historical society type of stuff. And there was actually an undertaker from a long-standing family of undertakers in Dedham whose name was Comfort Weatherby. And I remember everything that I encountered because I never know when it might come back to me in a completely different context. But imagine that, your undertaker, his name is Comfort. And he was like, there's Comfort Jr. took over. His son embalmed this dude. Care of that. So like Comfort Jr., he salted away Comfort Senior, and it's just such a good grandfather name. Nobody would have a name like that now. You are more likely to be named Adolf than you are Comfort. So there it is.
Well, I love it. And by the way, these folks also publishing your essay on The Irishman, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, they're publishing that, and I know this is one of the ones you'd happen to comment on too. They're publishing Read the Ice, another
wow.
short story, the one that narrated by her. It's about a woman, and she has made a decision not to have children or another child. She has two for what's a very surprising reason, I think. And there's a bit of hockey in that, and she goes for a solitary stroll, and she encounters something which you found quite surprising, but is congruous in the ice. And yes, they're putting out the Irishman essay, which I was supposed to have added 500 words to, but I have not done that as yet. So yes, Salmagundi, meaning like a soup made up of lots of different ingredients, putting out a hat trick worth of stuff.
By the way, your story spines, and I'm getting caught up on some of the stories you've sent, but man, Spines was an incredible story.
Spines is one where you have these pockets where I've now written over, I would estimate, probably like your average writer writes 8,000 words a year. It's not very much. They spend more time talking about writing than actually writing something. I've now written, in addition to the novel in a week and all these op-ed, everything, crazy, the blog for anyone who follows that, I've now written over 70 short stories going back to June of last summer. And about 40 of them come from July, after I wrote one called City this year. And most of them are about, or narrated, or both, by women. And this particular story, Spines, is about a mother who takes her child home. And the first night she's home, she's upstairs alone with her child. She wants to have this sort of private moment while the husband is getting these plaudits on the phone from his dad, like the back claps and the cigar type of thing. And it's not selfishness. She just wants to have this sort of first moment. And she notices these sea urchin spines, like these spindles, coming through the skin of the child's shoulders. And as the story develops, what has to happen is she has to literally kill her child every night so that it will be able to live. And it's what a mother, the extent a mother will go to on behalf of a child, for a child, to take this kind of thing. And the child's very young. It's just a matter of hold and twist. And then later, the child can talk, and it's a happy kid, and it's happy because she's doing this. She's making a sacrifice every night, and it requires more subtlety on her part because now it's bigger, it's stronger, and nobody knows this. And eventually, it passes, and the story comes to this kind of breakthrough moment. But when I got the idea, like a few months ago, I thought, like, man, where does this even come from? Like, who thinks of something? It sounds maybe a little garish, like it's going to be horrible. It's a harsh. It's not. A very beautiful story of love, ultimately. I was trying to read it to my friend John the other day, and you'll understand this. I couldn't get through sections of it. Like, here we are, two guys, like in their 40s, and I'm breaking up on the phone with this man because it's devastating.
Oh,
it's devastating.
It is.
Beautiful.
It's powerful, and it stays with you. Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Colin, we thank you much, as always, and we'll check in with you again soon.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.